Right. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar is the marriage of Kibiru versus Kalima. We are ready for oral arguments. It's a Zoom format this morning. You'll notice there's a timekeeping mechanism in the left-hand corner of the screen. Please be mindful of that. Also watch for judges to signal an interruption or a question. And Mr. Lanners, we heard you much better in the test when you were closer to the screen, so I would encourage you to stay as close as you can to your laptop so we have no difficulty hearing you, and we'll let you know if we do. Each side will have 15 minutes for argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Would counsel for appellant introduce himself for the record and begin oral argument?
May it please the court, counsel Alan Lanners representing the appellant, Mr. Kalima, in this matter. I'd like to start with a brief introduction, and then I have several points to cover. There are numerous cases cited by the respondent in their brief, and I believe about 18 in all. All of those cases are distinguishable from this case in very significant ways. In fact, the respondent only cited one case where the defaulting party was completely unaware of the proceedings. And that case was Howard versus Frondell, and it was a non-family court case. And in fact, in that case, the party had counsel who was in contact several times with the plaintiff's attorney and was told in no uncertain terms that an answer needed to be submitted by a certain date, and yet no answer was forthcoming in that case. In this case, it is extremely apparent from the record that the district court had an erroneous view of the facts in at least one important aspect. It's clear from the record that the court believed that Mr. Kalima was aware of the proceedings and the fact that he was due in court, at least for the ICMC hearing, and that he chose to ignore that fact. Based on the record, is not true. Mr. Kalima's address, whether intentionally or unintentionally, was not provided to the court. And it is clear that the court notices that were not sent to Mr. Kalima because they did not have his address. The court notices clearly indicate that there was no address for Mr. Kalima on file. No notice of any kind beyond the summons that Mr. Kalima was served with was ever provided to him. The court indicated to some degree at the hearing that it did not believe Mr. Kalima's version of the facts. Based on the fact that Mr. Kalima related that he went to the courthouse on February 6th and went to the self-help center to see what he should do about this proceeding, the court seemed to find that the fact that he went there on February 6th when judgment had been entered on February 4th, just 2 days earlier, to be more than just a coincidence. In fact, the court in the transcript states that Mr. Kalima magically showed up at the courthouse, apparently believing that Mr. Kalima had been notified of the fact that judgment was entered, and that's what caused him to come to the courthouse, and that his presence at the courthouse on February 6th was in response to some notice of entry of judgment. But in fact, no notice of entry of judgment was ever received by Mr. Kalima in this case. Mr. Kalima, in turn...
Mr. Lanners, the argument that you're describing right now, I'm struggling to see how it fits exactly with the law that this court has to apply in the case. We've got to look at the Bindon factors and the district court's analysis of the Bindon factors. I do understand, first of all, you know, that our court and all courts prefer to resolve cases on the merits and not to proceed by default. I mean, that's just a given. We all understand that value. But having said that, in family law cases, there is a very specific statutory construct that does allow for entry of a default dissolution decree with certain conditions, and then also allows your client, in this case where default was entered, to come back to the district court and say, I want to vacate that, and I'm going to demonstrate the grounds for vacature. And our district court judge did follow, as I see it, the applicable law and evaluated the Findon factors and tested this default judgment to see whether there wasn't a reasonable excuse for your client's failure to respond. And so I appreciate that you're, you know, giving us your own view of how things went awry in district court, but if you could fit it into those Findon factors, that would help me.
Thank you, Your Honor. I regret if I did not adequately frame this portion of the argument in terms of how it relates to the law in the matter. In fact, the district court found that two of the Findon factors were satisfied in this case. The two that it found were not satisfied were a lack of excusable neglect and lack of a reasonable defense on the merits. The what I've said so far goes to the issue of excusable neglect. My point, to be more succinct about it, is that it's clear from the record that the court believed that Mr. Kalema had more knowledge of what was going on in the case than he really had. And the court believed that Mr. Kalema was aware of the court proceedings and that he simply chose to ignore them. And that is not the case based on the record. The court.
If I can follow up, Mr. Lanners, you know, when you say aware of court proceedings, so earlier you specifically referred to the ICMC hearing. I mean, it's not required for a party, in this case, the petitioner below, the wife, to establish that the husband was aware of the ICMC. I mean, what's required for a default judgment is service of the complaint and the summons and then a failure to respond within a period of time. And then obviously the other things can follow from that. But and that is what was shown. And your client admits he was personally served with the dissolution petition, and which the summons indicates that there is no known address for your client. He could have, as he did later, follow up and given the court his address, but he didn't do that until much later.
Thank you, Your Honor. My point more goes to the fact that the summons was the only notice of this proceeding that Mr. Kalema ever received. And I think that there's a reason why there's a dearth of case law that's extremely similar to this case. And at the risk of wandering into speculation, I think we can conclude that the reason that there are very few cases like this one is that in a normal situation where the only notice that was given to the respondent was the summons and no other notices, that the court is generally inclined to reopen a decree, especially if there's an extremely timely motion to do so. And Mr. Kalema's motion to reopen the decree could not have been any more timely. And he naturally assumed that there would be other notices coming to him. I think it's important for this court to note that in her affidavit, Ms. Kibiru Kalema admitted that she basically knew where Mr. Kalema was throughout this proceeding. She says that he was not living with her, and in fact, he says that he was generally sleeping in his vehicle outside the marital home. But she reports that on security cameras, she observed Mr. Kalema coming into the house on a daily basis and making himself at home. So in effect, he was present at the home during the times that Ms. Kalema was not there and was working. The court should note that this case was filed only about 16 days after Mr. Kalema was served. Ms. Kalema could easily have provided Mr. Kalema with some form of notice at the homestead that the case was filed, that the court was now involved, and that he needed to do something to make his presence known to the court in order to avoid the default that happened in this case. This is an extremely long-term marriage, and contrary to the findings that were made by the court in this case, that Mr. Kalema has not shown that he has a reasonable defense or claim on the merits, there are many allegations that he made in connection with his motion to reopen that demonstrate that there are assets and debts that were not accounted for in the decree that was submitted to the court in this matter. These parties were married for a very long time, and Ms. Kibiru Kalema is a highly compensated investment professional that works for American Express. As stated in Mr. Kalema's proposed answer and counter petition, document index number 22, which he submitted with his motion to reopen, Ms. Kibiru Kalema has at least one and maybe even two retirement plans in addition to the one that she told the court about in the decree that she submitted by default. And neither of these plans were accounted for in the decree, nor subject to any division. Mr. Kalema is employed at a much lower level than his wife. She owned and controlled the majority of the assets. And under the circumstances of this case, granted, this does not have to be a precedential opinion, but under the circumstances of this case, where the wife knew where Mr. Kalema was throughout the process, knew exactly where to find him, knew that he could be given further notice that he needed to do something or there was going to be a default judgment, she should.
So, Mr. Lanners, one of the issues I'm struggling with here, and I can hear that you, as you did in your brief, you've challenged two of the defendant factor prongs. You know, you're saying there was a reasonable excuse on the merits, but you're focusing on the wife's conduct and not on your client's conduct that I can see. And the district court clearly focused on your client's conduct. And then as far as whether there's a reasonable defense on the merits, you mentioned the retirement accounts. While there was perhaps some difference in the amount and specificity of the retirement accounts, the wife's retirement accounts, by the time of the final default decree, it was certainly disclosed in the initial petition. So, you know, I guess the point I'm trying to ask you about is our review here is for abuse of discretion. You know, we are not deciding the Findon factors in the first instance. And so if you could explain to me where you think the district court abused its discretion. Some judges would have granted your motion, but this judge didn't and had reasons for not doing it. So help me out.
I think that goes to what I started out with, Your Honor, in the respect that I think that the judge, the referee in this case, attributed to Mr. Kalema a higher degree of knowledge of what was going on in the case than was reasonable to attribute to him. I think that, the findings at least imply, if not specifically indicate, that Mr. Kalema was aware of the proceedings and chose to ignore them. He was served with the summons. And in his motion to reopen the decree, he details that he made efforts to obtain counsel unsuccessfully. And he simply did not know what to do and thought that he had more time than he actually had to address this situation. He went to the courthouse and went to the self-help center not that long after the 30-day period to respond to the summons had expired. He probably was aware of the fact that the 30 days was over, and he was seeking help from the self-help center to say, hey, what can I do about this? And when he went there, he was told that a judgment had been entered just 2 days earlier. But the referee in this case clearly believed, based on what she stated in the transcript about him magically showing up, that his coming to the courthouse was in response to the notice of entry of judgment, and that prior to that, he had ignored proceedings. It really does come down to a policy decision on the part of this court, whether we want in family court cases to have naked service of a summons with a spouse who knows where their spouse is and has every opportunity to provide further notice, and whether intentionally or unintentionally does not do so. Is that going to be enough to say that in a 30-year marriage, one person gets to take the majority of the assets from the other person? And the fact of the matter is that Mr. Kalema isn't even sure if he knows what all is out there, because there was no opportunity for discovery in the case, no opportunity to analyze the case on the merits, and no opportunity for the court reasonably to conclude that he doesn't have a defense on the merits. There just isn't enough information out there. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes to address the remaining issues on rebuttal. We'll now hear from the attorney for respondent. Sir, would you introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument?
Yes. May it please the court, my name is Leopold Pei, and I represent the respondent, Brenda Ann Kiberu, in this case. Inasmuch as the appellant would like to make this case a case about notice, and in as much as the appellant would like to deny that he had notice, it is very important to note, as has been stated in the appellant's, in the respondent's brief, and as the record shows, personally, with not just a summons, but was also served with a petition for a dissolution. The summons clearly informed the appellant of his need to respond to the petition within 30 days and of what the consequences would be if he did not respond to the summons within 30 days. The consequences being that the respondent would receive all that she asked for in the petition. For the fact that the respondent, that the appellant was personally served, the respondent had a full opportunity to appear in this case, to present an answer, to fully contest this case. The appellant made no appearance whatsoever. Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure 5.01 provides that a party makes an appearance in a case when the party either serves or files a document after being served with a pleading. In this case, the appellant did not make any appearance at all. The appellant did not serve any document. The appellant did not file any document. Even more, the appellant made no attempt, absolutely no attempt, to contact the respondent's counsel to ask for an extension of time to file an answer. The record shows that the appellant was also served with a certificate of representation, which contained the respondent's attorney's contact information. as the court noted earlier.
So, Mr. Appé, I'd like you to talk about the other ground. You seem to be focusing on the reasonable excuse prong of the defendant factors, but we do have the whether there's a reasonable defense on the merits as well. And I think there the question is whether the district court's default decree actually, I mean, there are a couple of issues raised by the appellant, but one of them is whether it actually dealt with all of the property that the parties had and whether the property division is complete. So one of them, in response to, in support of his motion to vacate, the husband provided a copy of a statement showing that there is a second mortgage on the home. I think it's around $27,000. And obviously that's not addressed in the default decree. So does that give a basis to vacate or modify the default decree?
Sorry, absolutely, Judge. I was just about to start discussing the abuse of discretion and the Finden factors. As the court noted earlier, the only avenue, the one and only avenue that the appellant has in satisfying, in getting relief and reopening the judgment is through Minnesota Statutes 518.145. The appellant has to prove at least one of the statutory grounds listed in that statute. And the appellant's motion was based on excusable neglect, among a few other things, fraud, misrepresentation, and other misconduct on the part of the respondent. The crux of the motion was based on excusable neglect. And the district court did, in fact, fully address all four of the Finden factors that are required to be met in order to amount to excusable neglect. It's important to note that all four factors need to be met. With respect to the four factors, the factors are that one, the appellant has a reasonable excuse on the merits. Appellant has a reasonable excuse for failure to neglect to answer the petition. Three, that the appellant acted with due diligence after notice of entry of judgment. And four, that no substantial prejudice will result to the other party. With respect to reasonable defense on the merits, the appellant argues that the property division in this matter was not equitable. The district court relied on the pleadings and on the party's affidavits in making a decision in this case. With respect to the specific question that the court has in terms of there possibly being another document to be addressed by the court, that matter also, it is worth taking a deep look at the circumstances in this case. For one thing, the appellant was served with a copy of that petition, and the respondent, to the best of her ability and to the best of her knowledge, listed each and every asset that she knew about.
Oh, Mr. Appé, maybe my question wasn't specific enough. Here, the district court received a motion to vacate the default judgment, and the husband's affidavit included documentation of a second mortgage on the home that, and I'm not contending that your client was misleading the court in any way, but for whatever reason, was not included in the default decree. All right. So we have apparently a marital debt that was not included in the dissolution decree. So our district court judge apparently didn't catch that, because it's not mentioned in the reasons for the district court's decision. So what do we do? What do you do? What do your clients do? We have a problem, don't we? And if we don't, tell me why it's not a problem.
Right. Well, it's important to note as to take a look at the actual judgment itself. The judgment calls for a sale of the property, and that the proceeds of this property to be split equally. For the fact that it has to deal with the with the mortgage, that mortgage that the appellant raised or produced is something that will be dealt with at the time that the real estate is sold. It has to be. And going back to why that wasn't dealt with during the time of the pleadings, the respondent again was aware that if this wasn't stated in the petition, he had his full opportunity to participate, to conduct discovery, to contest these hearings, and he simply chose not to. And now we're left to looking squarely at Minnesota Statutes 518.13, subdivision 5, as to how to take care of this case, nothing else. And the burden still rests with the appellant in proving the statutory grounds. As the court's order denying the appellant's motion to vacate clearly goes through all the Findon factors for finding excusable neglect, clearly addresses all of the two other statutory grounds that the appellant raised. And also the court made a deep analysis and assessment and evaluation of both parties' affidavits. In Rodrance versus Brill, the Supreme Court stated that the discretion of the district court is particularly broad when the court's decision.
What do you say in response to Mr. Lanner's argument that there is no other reported case by this court where a dissolution decree entered in default has been upheld, where the record reflects that the party who then later has challenged here, it's the husband, the decree had, the only notice they had was service of the summons and petition. I recognize that's all that's required by the statutes and the related rules. But, you know, the reality is that we don't have other cases that show this type of record. So how do you respond to that argument?
Yes, the fact that there might not be other cases that address that does not mean that the district court's decision of denying the appellant's motion is wrong. Again, the main inquiry here is whether everything was done lawfully, whether the respondent followed the law, whether the district court followed the law. And there's no indication here that shows that the law wasn't followed either by the respondent or by the district court. Rather, the record shows that the individual who chose not to comply with the law, not to follow the law, is the appellant. And to to hold otherwise, to hold a, to reach a contrary conclusion, in other words, to reopen this matter would be rewarding the appellant for not following the law and penalizing the respondent for following the law. Decisions are not, the court should not make a decision in this case just based on sympathy. The court should make a decision based on the law, based on precedent, and based on justice. It would be greatly unjust for the respondent to be punished in this matter for having fully complied with the law. And for these reasons, the respondent respectfully asked the court to affirm the lower court's ruling in denying Mr. Kalema's motion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear rebuttal argument from Mr. Lanners, if he desires.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first say that it's not punishment to require that there be a fair and equitable division of marital assets. To be as succinct as I can, again, with respect to the two Findon factors, the court abused its discretion in its findings with respect to both of those factors. First, in finding that Mr. Kalema's neglect of the proceeding was not excusable, the court abused its discretion under the circumstances of this case. Mr. Kalema, not knowing the legal system, was essentially living in the same household as the petitioner throughout this process. It would be natural for him to assume that in addition to being served with a summons, that he would get some sort of notice from the court, which he never got. Again, not focusing on the conduct of the respondent in this case, she did admit that she knew that he was living at the house. Had she provided the court with that address for Mr. Kalema and had mail come to that address addressed to him, then he would have known that the court was involved in the case. Secondly, he tried on numerous occasions to get an attorney, and he relates that in his motion to reopen the decree. For whatever reason, he was not successful in obtaining an attorney, and so he went to the courthouse self-help center, and he did that only a matter of a few weeks at most after the 30-day period had expired. Again, it just so happened that he showed up 2 days after the judgment had been entered. It's clear from the court's findings that the court attributed notice and knowledge to Mr. Kalema that he did not, in fact, have, and that was the basis for determining that his neglect was not excusable. And in fact, in this case, it clearly is. With respect to the second Findon factor, the finding of no claim on the merits, I will say again that this is a very long-term marriage. In his answer and counterpetition, he alleges that there's an incentive savings plan that Ms. Kibiru Kalema has that's not included in the decree. He alleges that there's a supplemental pension plan that Ms. Kibiru Kalema has that's not included in the decree. As the court has already pointed out, he alleges that there are several debts that the parties owe that were not included in the decree. The decree on its face really makes no attempt to equalize the retirement assets or otherwise show why the division of assets in the decree is something close to equal, which would be the norm in this type of situation. And finally, Your Honors, the court does not want this to be the precedent in family law cases. The court does not want a a situation where a spouse believes that if they hide the ball from the other party, that they can prevail and that they can obtain the majority of the assets, even though the whereabouts of the responding party are known the entire time. The court found that the Findon factor of no prejudice to the respondent was satisfied in the event that it were to reopen this case, other than, of course, the inherent prejudice in every case of having to litigate the matter over again. But for counsel for the respondent to say that it would be punishing her to reopen the case and require a fair division of the assets here is simply not correct. And for those reasons, I think that reversal is required in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate the arguments from both attorneys in the briefing. The matter is submitted.